these aren't amounts of money that the state could see a real future in.
What it could look like if the state has no fiscal plan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 14th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes, filling in for Lori Townsend. Also tonight, fishing problems in the lower Yukon.
Our way of life out here is in jeopardy due to a simple part for an ice machine.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Governor Bill Walker's administration has spelled out what it would mean if the legislature doesn't take action on his plan to fund state government. With no more money, in 2 years, the state would have to slash services, jobs, and the support it gives to local schools and communities. From the Capitol, APRN's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
It's about noon on a workday, and the Glen Alps Trailhead in Chugach State Park near Anchorage is already packed with vehicles. Sarah and Reed Soup walk down the trail from Flat Top with their dog and chat with reporter Ann Hillman.
What's your dog's name?
Olia. She enjoying her hike?
She is.
She's going to be tired for like the next week. It's going to be awesome.
The couple moved up to Alaska for hikes like this. Together, they start looking through a list of potential cuts to state government if the legislature doesn't find new revenue sources. The governor put forth two scenarios. If lawmakers do nothing, the budget is hacked by 85%.
But look at like fish game and all those, that would change from 134 to 18.
Oh. You'd never get to go hunting or fishing. I think this is kind of like what people in Alaska
live here for.
Is the fishing, the hunting, the parks. And if we cut all the funding for that, I think
it's gonna deteriorate.
Yeah.
They say they'd happily pay more for fishing licenses and park fees to help that problem, but they see the projected cuts to education as too damaging. Schools would have thousands of fewer teachers. Some university campuses would close. Governor Walker says that if legislators don't pass his fiscal plan, which includes restructuring the permanent fund and adding new taxes, they'll be choosing that scenario as the state's future by default.
I asked for other plans. If there's a better plan, please bring it to us. And no plan came forth. But actually, you know, the other day on a flight to Fairbanks, it sort of struck me that there really is another plan. And that's the plan. That's the no action plan.
State Budget Director Pat Pitney says the no action plan would cut funding to state agencies from more than $4 billion to only $1.5 billion. Creating a dire situation.
These aren't amounts of money that the state could see a real future in.
Pitney says it would be like running a 21st century Alaska with roads and infrastructure on a budget from the 1960s. It's not possible. But Pitney says that only passing Senate Bill 128 wouldn't be enough to provide the government services and school aid that Alaskans are used to. SB 128 restructures the permanent fund and uses that money for operating costs. If we only do that, many state agencies would see a 25% cut in funding.
There's going to be downward pressure on all aspects that, with just a modest amount of tax revenue, we can maintain those services. We don't have to push the costs on to communities.
While Walker wants to spark the legislature to act, it hasn't worked. When he spelled out what could happen with future budgets, he said that as Alaskans become familiar with who supports the no action plan, they'll be better informed about who should represent them in Juneau. House Minority Leader Anchorage Republican Cherise Millett questions this tactic.
I think it's unfortunate that that's the way the governor chooses to work with the legislature. When you're trying to push a fiscal plan, I think the last thing you want to do is threaten folks with campaigns.
And some legislators didn't feel threatened by the possibilities. They embrace them. Wasilla Republican Representative Lynn Gaddis says she'd like to see the scenario with deep cuts.
In my district, when I went back home, those folks are saying cut the budget. And so certainly that's what this does. So I don't think these are dire circumstances.
Back at the state park, Palmer resident Linda Lozenoff and her family are about to head up the trail. She says it's time for the legislature to pick a path.
I really appreciate Governor Walker's efforts to take them to task, make them work hard and make decisions.
But she says everyone in the state, including schools, needs to do their part and accept some cuts.
Well, I'll give you an example. I am recently divorced, and I had to, a couple years ago, reduce my income by, oh my gosh, let's see, by about two-thirds. And if I was able to do it, I think that the state can do it.
With help from Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman in Anchorage, I'm Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau.
Two former commissioners and several lawmakers are criticizing Governor Bill Walker's decision to veto more than $430 million from the state's budget. The money would have gone to pay tax credits to oil companies. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney reports on the fight brewing over the state's mounting oil tax credit bill.
Two former commissioners are encouraging state lawmakers to override Governor Bill Walker's budget veto that would delay hundreds of millions in oil tax credit payments to companies. They say Walker's decision destroys the state's credibility with the industry it depends on to develop oil and gas resources.
What seems to have developed in this particular moment is the governor having to kind of take hostages in order to get the legislature to act on what he wants them to act on with regard to a fiscal plan.
That's former Department of Revenue Commissioner Patrick Galvin. He's currently the chief commercial officer for Great Bear Petroleum, one of the independent producers that's waiting on those payments the state is putting off. Galvin and former acting commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, Marty Rutherford, wrote an editorial in the Alaska Dispatch News saying the state's refusal to pay its tax credit bill could have a chilling effect on development. Galvin says the governor's veto will be felt not just by companies like Great Bear, but by all of the businesses that support the oil and gas industry in the state.
It has an impact down the chain for all of the business that that company wanted to do, and they were expecting to get these payments, and now they're basically stuck waiting to see when the state will ultimately pay its bill.
Rutherford has not returned repeated calls seeking comment since she stepped down as acting DNR commissioner in late June. Lawmakers have also pushed back against the governor's veto. Members of the Senate Finance Committee grilled Tax Division Director Ken Alper on the veto during a special session meeting in Anchorage on Wednesday. Alper told legislators that the governor's decision to veto the credits is necessary without a comprehensive fiscal plan to bring the state out of its budget hole.
In the absence of that, suddenly, the governor's larger concern is, how are we going to keep the lights on 2 and 3 years from now? You know, we were on a path to deplete the constitutional budget reserve a year from now.
Alper's explanation and his presentation on the hundreds of millions in deferred credits that will hang over the state in future budget years drew the ire of Fairbanks Republican Senator Pete Kelly.
Yeah, Ken, what you've done, it appears to me, is you've put together a slide that essentially cries out, help stop me before I make another irrational veto. Because as Senator McKinnon said, you created a problem, and now you're saying that somehow the problem that the governor created with the veto, that we have to make a complete fix to our, a complete change to our oil taxing regime rather than just have him start acting a little more savvy.
The State House has invited the Senate to meet Friday to discuss voting to override the tax credit veto and the more than $1 billion Walker stripped from the budget. That includes a $1,000 per person reduction to the permanent fund dividends this year. The Senate has yet to accept the invitation. They'll need a three-quarter majority vote or 45 of the 60 legislators to overturn any of the governor's vetoes. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Senate President Kevin Meyer told the Alaska Journal of Commerce late this afternoon that the body won't accept the House's invitation to meet and discuss the tax credit vetoes. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new museum exhibit tells the story of the pipeline and the boom-bust history of Alaska.
So is there just a missing piece of pipeline out there?
No, these are spooled parts.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A broken ice machine has stalled commercial fishing for two villages on the lower Yukon River, and no one will fix it. Fishermen have to travel 90 miles and back to get ice, and they're calling for help. Meanwhile, the fish and the opportunity for income are swimming by. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Fishermen in Marshall and Russian Mission have missed three commercial openings since the machine's compressor broke last week. They're missing on yet another opening today and two more if the problem isn't fixed by this weekend. And it most likely won't be, because this problem is an expensive one, $15,000.
Our way of life out here is in jeopardy due to a simple part for an ice machine.
Nick Andrew Jr. is a commercial fisherman in Marshall. There are 48 commercial fishermen in his village in Russian Mission. All of them are small skiff operations, and all of them rely on Marshall's now-defunct ice machine. The machine holds 8,000 pounds of ice. During an opening, fishermen use about half that per day. Marshall's village corporation, Masurkulik, owns the machine, but is refusing to fix it, a situation, Andrew says, that's frustrating villagers.
Basically, you know, this has angered a lot of us fishermen and shareholders because, one, it's their property. Two, they're profiting off the fishermen.
Profits come from buying items at the corporation's store. Andrew says the issue speaks to an ongoing disconnect between the shareholders and their corporation. Four of its five board members don't live in Marshall, and the CEO lives in Wyoming. CEO Russell Weller Jr. replied to KYUK's phone call with no comment. Board members have not responded to emails. In past years, the ice machine has been maintained by Quickpack Fisheries. It's downriver in Amonic and the processor that buys the fish. The machine breaks several times per year, and Quickpack's always fixed it for free. Until now. Manager Jack Schulteis says they've already fixed the machine five times this year, and it's time the owners took responsibility.
I mean, the whole community basically fishes, but they won't support their own fishermen. And we just feel that it's something that the village corporation should address and not us.
The fishermen in Marshall and Russian Mission offered to pay for the repair on credit with QuickPack. Schulteis wouldn't take the financial risk.
Some of them haven't even fished this year. And if it's all split equally, then everybody would have to fish. So what happens if a portion of them doesn't fish?
A new machine would cost about $100,000. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Three telemedicine programs in Alaska are receiving $900,000 in new funding from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Secretary Tom Vilsack announced the award this morning. The Tananaw Chiefs Conference will receive $375,000 to expand their telemedicine program in two dozen rural villages. Hope Community Resources will purchase video conferencing equipment with their $280,000 grant. The organization provides services to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental health challenges around the state. Almost $300,000 will go to the Arctic Slope Native Association to buy a remote dispensing system for medications. Currently, people in their remote communities can only get prescriptions by mail. USDA is also giving the Copper River School District nearly $500,000 to provide distance learning programs for five elementary schools in extremely rural villages. Three sites are on Alaska Native Trust lands. A Haines tribe is calling a recent U.S. Court of Appeals decision an historic victory. The Chilkoot Indian Association was among five plaintiffs in a lawsuit challenging what's known as the Alaska Exception, which prohibited Alaska tribes from placing their lands into federal trust. After years of litigation, including an appeal from the state, the federal court sided with the tribes. As KHNS's Emily Files reports, this will have a small but meaningful impact on the Chilkoot Indian Association.
It's a historic decision, and our name is on that lawsuit, and that means a lot, and I think that our people should be very proud of that fact.
Harriet Brulette is the tribal administrator for the Chilkoot Indian Association. She says the tribe got involved in the case because there was inequality between the rights of tribes in Alaska and the rest of the United States.
We weren't being treated equally, so this is... The Chilkoot Indian Association played a historical part in making sure that all tribes are created equally.
In the 1930s, the Indian Reorganization Act was put into place, which allowed the U.S. Secretary of the Interior to acquire trust lands. Placing land into trust gives it permanent protection for a tribe's exclusive use. Reservations are an example of this. But the 49th state was excluded from that right because of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which distributed land to Alaska Native people and created Native corporations. About 10 years ago, Akiachak, Tulisak, Chalkitsik, the Chilkoot Indian Association, and a Barrow individual filed suit. They said the Alaska exception violated the Indian Reorganization Act's anti-discrimination provision by treating Native tribes differently. The district court agreed and struck down the Alaska exception, but the process was put in limbo by an appeal from the state of Alaska. But early this month, the court dismissed it.
What this will do is give us... some sovereign authority over our own land so that we can make decisions just like any other tribe in the lower 48 does about how we use our land. And we, like any other sovereign nation, we won't have to ask permission from anybody but ourselves.
Brulette says the tribe applied years ago to put land, including the Chilkoot Estates subdivision and other small parcels, into trust. But she says the Chilkoot tribe is different than the other plaintiffs in the lawsuit, in that it doesn't have much land.
What was once our land is now a checkerboard of various ownerships that have nothing to do with the tribe.
Brulette says the court decision is a rare positive event after many losses for the tribe.
You know, our tribe is small. Because our community became a predominantly a non-Native community, I mean, we were about 18% of the population. It's been a struggle, you know, to maintain ourselves like a tribe. And I think this is an opportunity for us, and it's not just an opportunity for us, but I think it's going to benefit the community as well.
Brulette says the status they hope to gain for their remaining property would give the tribe authority over taxes and could allow for economic development opportunities. Because the Chilkoot Indian Association's land is limited, she says the land into trust decision's symbolic importance may outweigh the practical changes the future holds. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
New wildfires are burning in interior and southwest Alaska today due to thousands of lightning strikes across the state on Wednesday. Tim Mowry, a fire information officer with the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center in Fairbanks, says about 40 fires have been reported since yesterday.
Lightning holdovers. There were a lot of lightning strikes yesterday out near McGrath and in the Copper River Basin.
He says the McGrath area is the hardest hit, with 22 new fires reported Wednesday and another 8 reported today. Many of the fires are burning in remote areas, and no action is being taken at this time. More than 7,000 lightning strikes were recorded Wednesday, with more expected by the end of today. Two fires are burning in the Copper Basin. Mowry says firefighters dropped retardant on the blaze about a mile from the Toke Cutoff Road.
It was right near the boundary of the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. Water wasn't effective, so they got permission to drop retardant.
He says it slowed the fire, and crews are finishing up. The cutoff fire is 80% contained.
We've got a couple of crews on there right now, and they'll be mopping up the fire today.
The 60-acre Chistochina Fire River fire was reported Wednesday evening and is about 20 miles east of Paxson Lake on the Richardson Highway. Two cabins could be threatened by it, and the situation is being monitored. Closer to Fairbanks, water scooping buckets and hand crews contained the Dry Creek Fire. The Lower Washington Creek blaze burned about a mile from the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and has since been contained.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN, and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to four-year colleges or other post-secondary education. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
Juneau police say two adult siblings whose bodies were found this week both died of accidental drowning. In a statement, police say the determination was made following autopsies conducted on the bodies of George and Christina Young. 40-year-old George Young was found lying face down in Lemon Creek on Sunday. His 36-year-old sister was considered missing until her body was found Tuesday on a beach of North Douglas. Police say they are awaiting toxicology reports, which could take up to 2 months. When George Young's body was found, police indicated alcohol was a factor. The shooting death of a puppy in Fairbanks, the Fairbanks area, has ignited community outcries as residents who have had similar experiences with their animals question how the authorities respond to such incidents. Dan Powell tells the Fairbanks Daily Newsminer he let his dog out to use the bathroom when it went missing. After searching his neighborhood, he came home to find his young dog, Lucy, shot dead in his driveway. Powell took to a community Facebook page to share the incident with others who reported similar stories about their dogs going missing and being shot. Many also expressed outrage that the Alaska State Troopers aren't investigating the incident. Trooper Scott McAfee attended a meeting organized by the community Sunday. He urged residents to keep their dogs secured and said he'd continue to monitor the situation. The State Archives and Library Museum, or SLAM, opened recently in Juneau with a new display that includes a piece of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline as part of an exhibit on the oil industry. But the drama of the state's current fiscal crisis puts that history in a new light. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins wondered how the present might someday reshape the past.
Steve Hendrickson tells stories with things. Sometimes those objects go way back, like woven baskets from 6,000 years ago. But part of Hendrickson's job as a museum curator is also collecting items from this century. And that can take some guesswork.
Trying to figure out, you know, what in 100 years from now will be significant to people then that speak to our time in history.
And when it comes to significant events that happened recently, or relatively recently, Hendrickson says there was something missing in the museum's permanent collection.
Oil became Alaska's richest resource in 1967 with the discovery
the development of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. So the museum went to work to try to find pieces for its new building from that point in history. Now behind glass, there's a drill bit, an engineering uniform worn on the North Slope, and much more. There's a big part of what made it all happen.
So is there just a missing piece of pipeline out there?
No, these are old parts.
Under the dim museum lights, the section of pipeline looks like a rusty football goalpost with a circular tube balanced on top. Bob Banghart, the museum's deputy director, says other collectors have a piece of it, but
I don't think anybody's got a piece that's actually standing 18 feet off the floor.
3 years ago, Banghart says the museum approached Alaska Pipeline Service Company, which runs the pipeline.
And at first they were kind of, interesting, and we explained our intent.
Banghart says they wanted to show a continuous theme with the whole museum collection.
The human mind's creative adaptability.
If you look back in history, the development of the pipeline helped solve a huge problem. How do you transport valuable crude from the North Slope down to the lower 48? Do you try to float it on an ice-breaking tanker through the Northwest Passage? That's something the oil industry actually tried, and it worked once, but that was deemed impractical. The pipeline, on the other hand, made transporting the oil much easier. Binghart says you can see that same ingenuity in other items, like the spear point.
So we felt that the corollary between the pipeline and a spear point was established enough so that we wanted a piece of the pipeline.
But there's another recurring theme in Alaska's history that keeps coming up inside the museum.
The state's economy and government finances came to rely largely on oil revenue, but oil is not a sustainable resource and is running out.
Steve Hendrickson is reading off a plaque in the museum called Timber, Oil, and the Quest for Sustainability. He says you can see a boom and bust cycle in other time periods, in displays about the fur trade, the gold rush, and logging in the Tongass National Forest.
If people went to exhibits like this and paid more attention to human history, I think we could avoid some of those problems. But we're all human beings, and we don't always make the best possible decisions.
For the museum itself, the current fiscal crisis has meant scaling back. Hendrickson is doing double duty, working his job as a curator and filling in at the front desk. The museum hasn't been able to bring on seasonal workers due to the state's hiring freeze. But Hendrickson says he doesn't mind. He likes the opportunity to mingle with visitors and talk with them about what they've learned, even though some of the history behind the exhibits isn't always a happy one.
We're not trying to tell a feel-good story here. We're trying to put the facts out there, and people can decide for themselves what it might mean.
As for what's going to happen in Alaska's future, Hendrickson says he'll be watching and collecting. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
And lastly, a story we aired yesterday about the Department of Education grants for pre-elementary programs contained a mistake. One of the five districts receiving a renewal grant is not the Yukon-Kuskokwim, but rather the Yukon-Kayakuk School District. And that is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Elizabeth Jenkins, and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Ann Hillman and Ellen Locke here in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Emily Files in Haines. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Ann Hillman produced tonight's show. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
The Arctic is wild, remote, and untouched. See how contemporary artists challenge the mythical ideal of the North in the Anchorage Museum exhibition, View from Up Here, the Arctic at the Center of the World, on view through October the 2nd. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum. APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every day. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.